From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Unbelievable with Stacey Horn. Ghosts, telepathy, and poltergeists. Looking forward to that. You know, the value of global financial assets, including stocks, bonds, and currencies, probably, they say, fell by more than $50 trillion last year, equivalent to a year of the world gross domestic product. This according to the Asian Development Bank. And of course, stocks tumbled again on Monday with the Dow ending at fresh 12-year lows. Confidence level right now is just very low. At a White House ceremony attended by scientific leaders, President Obama ordered the National Institutes of Health to issue guidelines removing the Bush administration's limits on human embryonic stem cell research funding within 120 days. Federal funding, to the extent permitted by law, will become available for hundreds of human embryonic stem cells derived from colonies created since August 9th of 2001, many of them genetically marked for diseases such as diabetes or cancer. Under the Bush administration rules, only 21 stem cell lines had been eligible for research funding. Typically, couples donate excess embryos from fertility procedures to researchers. Researchers pull the 150 or so cells from inside one of those roughly six-day-old embryos, destroying it, and grow the cells in a lab. On the line with us now, Christian Wild, to react to this story and also the aortic valve replacement on Barbara Bush and upcoming on comedian Robin Williams. Christian, what's your reaction to this story? Because it seems that a lot of politicals are excited about it.
That's right, George, and you and I have talked about it for the past two or three years. Every article that I read blamed religion for holding back embryonic stem cell research. To a degree, that's true. But religion didn't hold back embryonic research from having a single success in countries all over the world that have been examining it and experimenting with it for more than 11 years. They have never produced a single documented cure in any country of the world. At the same time, the very diseases that they claim that will be cured with an embryonic stem cell, they list them. Governor Schwarzenegger just listed them again. MS, Parkinson's, heart failure, Alzheimer's, and let's see, several others.
Anyway, spinal injuries, too.
Of course, thank you, spinal injuries. And you and I know, and your listeners know, that every one of those diseases, we've had patients on the show in FDA trials that have been cured of those diseases. There are 100 diseases being cured with adult stem cells. Adult stem cells that do not get rejected by the body and have to put the patient on a lifetime of immune suppressive drugs. Embryonic stem cells, as you and I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the young boy who went to Moscow got fetal stem cells injected into his body. He ended up in Israel with tumors growing throughout his spine, throughout his brain. As has happened every time they put an embryonic stem cell into an animal study.
You believe that they should continue using adult stem cells, mm-hmm. not embryonic. Is that correct?
And many of the scientists around the world say we're so close right now that if we just spend a little more money on adult stem cells, we could accomplish everything that they project one day could happen with an embryonic. And then you've heard me quote several of the world leaders that say they see nothing coming from embryonic success for 20, 30, or even 40 years. There's a reason private enterprise has not put money into embryonic stem cell research. And the urgency now is that the government put it in. And the point is, you don't want to squander what we're so close to getting. And whether or not they're going to devote some of that money to adult stem cell research, we don't know.
Could adult stem cells be used to help people like Barbara Bush and soon-to-be Robin Williams when he gets his aortic valve replaced?
Well, yeah, because they're working on calcification right now, and that's what causes aortic valve disease. When aortic valve disease is developed, what's happened is the calcification is built up, and there's that word again.
Here we go, yeah.
Yeah, it builds up on the leaflets and on the valve itself. The valve, therefore, cannot seat properly. It doesn't allow the blood to flow through and bring oxygen to the rest of the body. In a process called regurgitation, it rejects the blood flow and forces it backwards. And what happens then is the patient is fatigued. The left ventricle enlarges, which can lead to congestive heart failure. Now, there's two options, George. You can either have a pig valve, a porcine valve, or a mechanical valve.
Or as they call a tissue valve, which is close to mechanical.
That's correct. But you noticed in the new newsletter, there's a valve in there that's a mechanical replacement valve that you do not have to have open heart surgery
Do
in all the other cases.
That's right. Robin Williams will have to undergo open heart surgery when he gets
there. He will, because this is still in trial. Now, They invited me to come to Cedars-Sinai to watch a procedure in which they take the little mechanical valve, just like an angioplasty, go up the artery.
Which lasts 200 years, I hear.
That's right. And drops it in place right over the existing disease natural valve and pop it with the balloon, and it opens up and locks itself in place. They withdraw, and the patient goes home in a couple days.
I got to tell you, Christian, when science is on, it's really on. Christian's website, myheartbook.com. He puts out a regular newsletter as well. If you want more information on it, again, it's at his website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The Obama administration has vowed to keep military surveillance in waters off China and protested to China about what it called harassment of an American ship doing the work last week. The Pentagon charged that a Chinese intelligence gathering vessel and four others shadowed and maneuvered dangerously close to the USNS Impeccable surveillance ship in the South China Sea on Sunday. Then they threw obstacles in the water as it tried to leave. Well, you better thank your lucky stars you don't live in Saudi Arabia. The sentencing of a 75-year-old widow in Saudi Arabia to 40 lashes and 4 months in prison. Why? What did she do? She mingled with two young men who were reportedly bringing her bread. It has now sparked new criticism of Saudi Arabia's ultra-conservative religious police. Khamisa Sawadi, who's a Syrian but was married to a Saudi, was convicted and sentenced last week for meeting with two men who were not her immediate relatives. The two men, including one who was her late husband's nephew, were also found guilty and sentenced to prison terms and lashes. In Granite City, Illinois, prosecutors have alleged that a Granite City man there shot and killed a neighbor's pet German Shepherd with a bow and arrow. An 18-year-old Samuel Null was charged with aggravated cruelty to an animal. Null told police apparently he was trying to scare the dog because it frequently came into the area of his backyard and was known to get into garbage containers. He claimed that he shot at a piece of wood to scare the dog, but hit the dog accidentally. Strong storms, including at least three tornadoes, damaged or destroyed homes in parts of the Midwest, and rainfall brought fears of more misery to areas hit hard by flooding last year. National Weather Service confirmed that the damage in Illinois and Indiana on Sunday result of early tornadoes. On Earth, hurricanes, of course, form and dissipate in a matter of days. On Jupiter, storms can rage for years, even centuries. But now the Great Red Spot, the colossal storm twice the diameter of Earth, which has lasted at least 300 years, is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, all because of Jupiter's climate changes. Remarkable story here. A male chimpanzee in a Swedish zoo planned hundreds of stone-throwing attacks on zoo visitors, according to researchers. Keepers at the zoo found that the chimp collected and stored stones that he would later use as missiles. Further, the chimp learned to recognize how and when parts of his concrete enclosure could be pulled apart so he could make more. The findings are reported in the journal Current Biology. There's been a scant evidence in previous research that animals can plan for future events. Crucial to the current study is the fact that Santino, chimpanzee at the zoo in the city north of Stockholm, collected the stones while he was in a calm state prior to the zoo opening in the morning. The launching of the stones occurred hours later during dominance displays to zoo visitors when Santino was in an agitated state. This suggests that Santino was anticipating a future mental state, an ability that has been difficult to decisively prove in animals. Up there is the feature story at coasttocoastam.com. A poodle has become a local celebrity in China because he goes on a walk every day on 2 feet. He stands on his two back feet, and he walks, and you can see a picture of him. And an art exhibition in Holland gives people the chance to telephone God, but they have to leave a message. Dubbed God's Hotline, It aims to focus attention the way that Dutch people perceive religion. The artist chose a mobile phone number to show that God was available anywhere, anytime. The phone number has been active now for the past week, with 1,000 messages already left on the answer phone. In a moment, this is the 50th anniversary of one of those classic movies, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and the star of that film is with us, Pat Boone. Also, his latest work, Questions About God, How We Merge Science and Religion. Pat Boone is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, actor, singer, author, songwriter. Pat Boone's public career in entertainment began when he emceed a teenage talent show on radio and television in Nashville, Tennessee. And his very first professional recording was made in 1955. He joined ASCAP in 1961. Pat served as a board member for the Northeastern Institute for Christian Education. Here he is with us this hour on Coast to Coast. Pat, welcome back, my
friend. Great to be here in your den, your lair.
This is it, my Wizard of Oz lair, you know?
Yes, it is.
Back here behind the curtain. My 27-year-old son, who did not have an opportunity to grow up listening to you, heard you were going to be on the program tonight. Mm-hmm. He's staying up late in St. Louis
to hear
you.
And he said, Pat Boone, who is she?
You know what? He loves nostalgia. And I told him that this is the 50th anniversary of Journey to the Center of the Earth, one of my favorite movies, and our Coast fans love that movie. I'll talk with you a little bit about that and get into also this incredible new work that you and Cort Cooper have come up with. But he's all excited about this. I mean,
really?
I think young people nowadays need to understand things that got us to where we are today.
Yeah, I do. And it used to be a lot easier when families lived close to each other. Kids knew their grandparents and maybe lived on the next block or whatever. So there was, they heard their parents and their grandparents, if they were lucky, even their great-grandparents, talking about the old days. And they could sort of glom on to where they came from and what, you know, what the circuitous or maybe direct line was to who they are now. But these days, people can be so separated that they hardly know their parents, who work hard, maybe at several jobs, only see their grandparents rarely, and don't even think to ask them in many cases or hear the fabulous stories. For instance, my dad, I was taking him and Mama to Hawaii. They were in their early 80s, and we were on a 747.
Yeah.
We had had this wonderful meal. We were about 2.5 hours out of L.A., and Daddy and I stood to stretch, you know, in short sleeve shirts, and they were getting ready to show a movie. And I said, Daddy, you know, I've flown, I don't know, a million, million and a half miles. I don't know. I lost count a long time ago. And so I've done this so many times, but this, I still can't quite figure how this can be. We're standing here in our shirt sleeves. We're zipping through the sky at 630 miles an hour. We're 35,000 feet in the air out over the Pacific. We just had a nice meal. There's a fly buzzing around that got on in L.A. with us. We're going to watch a movie, and we're in perfect comfort. And how can this be, this giant building on its side with 250 people in it? He said, I know, it's really hard to get around this, especially when you can remember riding in a covered wagon.
Oh my!
I said, Daddy, what? Covered? You're kidding, aren't you? No. I knew that he grew up his earliest years in New Mexico. Out in close to Roswell.
Well, okay, good. he knows something.
He might have, except he got out before it all happened. But Clovis, they got water from a windmill. They had. I heard him talk about the party lines. That you know, they had phones, but you only answered the phone if it was your number of rings.
That's right. And you had to wait.
And
right?
You weren't supposed to pick up if it wasn't your number, but everybody did.
Yeah, and listened in, right?
Yeah, because there was no radio. There's no television. And there was an old car called an Allen that I knew about all that, but covered wagon? Daddy, what are you talking about? And he said, sure. He said, if we went from Clovis into Roswell, the slickest, most elite way was in a canvas-covered wagon drawn by a couple of horses, and his mother, Mother Boone, we called her, would put a blanket on a wooden bench.
Man.
And he was a little kid. He would lie on that wooden bench and just bounce along, you know, on the ruts in the road. And it kept the mud and the dirt, the rain, the wind out of the Kansas flaps, you know, protected him. And so this was the lap of luxury. So he went in his lifetime from covered wagon to 747.
Across the Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is something.
In just hours.
And maybe the UFO at Roswell was a covered wagon that flipped over or something, huh?
Yeah, maybe.
You never know.
There were unidentified moving wagons in those days.
Pat, can you believe it's been 50 years since you did Journey to the Center of the Earth?
No. I almost refused to, but I guess you're right. And I had to be talked into making that movie. I didn't want to do it.
Why?
Because
it's a great movie.
Well, looking back, I'm so glad I did. In fact, I could tell you a couple of interesting reasons why. But then I saw myself as a young Bing Crosby. I thought I was just going to make movie musicals.
Uh-huh.
And I did.
Okay.
I did make the first teen musical movie about teenagers with teenagers.
Uh-huh.
and with music. Johnny Mercer wrote the music. And who knew it was the first teen musical? But so that's what I thought I would do. That's what Bing Crosby had. I forgot that he did a Connecticut Yankee in
right.
King Arthur's Court. But I just thought, well, science fiction, Jules Verne, I mean, I'm under contract to 20th, and this is what they want to do. But I said, fellas, I really don't want to be in a science fiction film. That wasn't happening at the time. Kirk Douglas had done 20,000 Leagues Beneath the Sea. And that was a big hit, but that was the only one for years. And I said, I want to do musicals. They said, we'll put some music in it. I said, well, then it's just going to be some songs added to a science fiction film. But they talked me into it by giving me, and this was not really an inducement for me, but for my manager and agents it was, a piece of the film.
That's fantastic.
Of the gross after.
Oh, what a deal, huh?
Yes! It turned out to be the best ever because not only did the movie, was it a big success, and it continues to be.
It's a classic.
It's a classic.
Like a
cult classic. Yeah. But George, I'm not exaggerating, it saved 20th Century Fox Studio. Because while we were making Journey to the Center of the Earth, they were buried under the exorbitant, over-budget expense of Cleopatra.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor they'd leave for a week and leave the movie company just hanging while they disappeared.
And they
Spain.
Got paid. The movie company had to get paid. Still,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
And they were so far over budget and it was an extremely expensive film anyway. And the banks were getting ready to close 20th Century Fox down when Journey to the Center of the Earth premiered in Nashville, my hometown.
Right.
And then
went through the roof.
It just racked up tremendous grosses, and it convinced the bankers. To let 20th last a little longer. And it was an executive there that told me about that later. I didn't know it at the time. But so it not only was a great thing for me, but it saved the studio. So I'm very glad that I did it.
The redo that came out in 2008, last year, not quite like yours. You just can't redo these classics.
No, it's dangerous. Even when Michael Douglas did one of the funniest films of all that I think I ever saw, I think it was called The In-Laws, and Alan Arkin and Peter Falk did it. And then, I forget, Albert Brooks, I think, and Michael Douglas did it. And maybe a lot of the same jokes and plot lines, but it just
You just can't read on. I heard a great story about you. I'm going to use it before we go to the commercial break, Pat, and we're going to come back and talk about science and faith and see how we get to where we are today with questions about God. But I ran into a bass guitarist yesterday. He said he knows you. His name's Adrian, who happened to go to high school with a friend of mine from St. Louis, Johnny Rose. And he said, I want to tell you this quick story about Pat Boone because you've got him on tomorrow night. And he said, this guy's got to be one of the greatest guys in Hollywood. And I said, well, I know that, but why? And he said, years ago, Pat had a music director who wanted to cut his own CD.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Pat, I'm saving up for it, and it's going to cost me, you know, X amount of thousands of dollars to do. And Adrian told me, he says, without batting an eye, you reached for your checkbook and wrote him a check for that whole CD production. And you merely told the music director, whose name has escaped me, that you just wanted his first CD. Remember that?
Yes, I do. The only thing, I didn't write a check because I didn't carry a checkbook, but I committed to do it, and I did. I just didn't do it right there on the spot.
You're too honest. We'll be back in a moment with Pat Boone on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Pat Boone. We'll be back. We'll take your phone calls and continue chatting with him about something I think all of us just need to grasp right now, We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Pat Boone. We'll take your calls this hour as well. Pat, you teamed up with Court Cooper, who's an award-winning reporter, and came up with something that I think people always need, but probably more so now than ever. And this is this incredible belief system that there's more on this planet, there's more in this universe than we can imagine.
Yeah, you know, science fiction is built on that curiosity we have.
Yeah.
And the instinct that human beings do have that there's got to be something beyond ourselves. I mean, not only has it historically always been true, I personally believe that we are created that way. We are hardwired. And science, there's more and more evidence that we are literally hardwired to believe in something bigger than ourselves. And reason says so as well. And that the most brilliant brains that we know of in the last 200 years, and I'm talking about people like Stephen Hawking and Einstein himself, have come to that conclusion. I mean, with all of their brilliance and their scientific knowledge, and I can read some quotes about it, but there's a hunger as well. And as you say, when we're in tough times and suddenly the problems surrounding us seem maybe beyond our ability to solve, people start wanting to reach out beyond themselves. And I think there is not just the hunger, but there's a mushiness even among people who do believe. And I just heard today on the news, on Fox, I guess it was, that some 76% of people in America believe in God. There's about 15% that say they don't.
Right.
They're
right.
Atheists. But then there's a bunch that say they just don't know.
They just don't know.
Yeah. But among the 76% that say they do believe in God, about half of those are, you know, serious evangelical Christians. I'm not saying the others aren't serious, but, you know, you can have various temperatures and just not be sure about why you believe what you have decided you do believe. So this book, this guy Cord Cooper is a brilliant fella. He sent me a manuscript, which is the bulk of what has now become this book, Questions About God and the Answers That Could Change Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a manuscript, and he wanted to know if I could help, much like that guy with the record.
Right.
Well, when I read what he'd written, I said to my secretary, Janet, if this were in a published form, I would order 100 copies right now and send it to
your friends,
virtually
people,
everybody I could think of, because in really simple but deep and fundamental terms, he answers all these questions that float in the air all the time, and our kids are being bombarded in school quite often by their teachers and expected to parrot the teacher's views that there is no God, that there's that everything has occurred mindlessly through some random selection and evolution and a big bang and a primordial ooze, all these things that they can't prove, but the kids are expected to accept what these teachers say. And of course, the idea, the theory of intelligent design, which is equally scientific, in fact,
sure,
I think more scientific, based on the things that you read about in this book, is forbidden in most schools to be taught. And you know, Ben Stein has this film called Expelled,
right,
and he does a brilliant job of bearding the evolutionary lions in their dens and asking them questions as he goes almost in a Socratic way. He says, take me back to the origins, the beginnings. Where did it all come from? Well, you know, and they'll take you back to the Big Bang, the cosmos, the explosion. He says, well, then where did the matter come from? It had to originate somewhere, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, nothing can come out of nothing, or can it? No, that's not scientific. No. Then, and if matter existed, then where did the gases come from? And what ignited the Big Bang that created, supposedly, a universe so vast that we still can't comprehend it, and we haven't seen it all? We know there may be a whale of a lot more, even than it's just too many millions of miles away for us even to detect it. So where did it all come from? Now you find that we're all living by faith. Every one of
and
us.
And you have to.
Everybody's now, their faith is in a premise, there is no God, which they cannot prove. We, the majority, believe in a God, and for us, the evidence is everywhere. The Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament, that is the material things and the worlds, everything in it, shows his handiwork. So his fingerprints are all over it, and the evidence is everywhere. But whether we believe or don't believe, it is a faith system. I said this to Michael Newdow on the Crossfire.
Right.
Because he was the atheist, is the atheist, trying to take the two words under God out of our Pledge of Allegiance.
Uh-huh.
And I said...
Red Skelton would be cringy right now.
Yes, yes. You know about... You did.
Yeah.
I think you may have played that
I played that.
Once. Yeah. And so I said to Michael, you realize that... You're operating under a faith system. And he said, yeah. And I said, that faith system is there is no God, which you cannot prove, therefore it's faith. I believe there is a God. I think there's evidence everywhere. He says, yeah, but I don't try to force my view on you. I said, then why are you trying to take under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance when 95 or 100% of Americans want it there?
Want it there.
You don't like it. It offends you. So you want to impose your view, your faith, on us. Well, he couldn't quite answer that. But I think that these days we really need to take an intellectual, scientific, rational look at things, things all around us, and ask the right questions. Is it possible that this world, the universe that we now know, that Darwin knew nothing about, by the way, or little, he didn't know anything about microscopic particles. He didn't know about one-celled. I mean, he thought that things were much simpler than they really are. And as we point out in the book, the little one-celled flagellum, the simplest little organism that we can see under the microscope, except for submicroscopic things, but a living thing with a little tail that propels through fluid. And we have about 60 trillion of those in the average body, 60 trillion. Each one of those cells has some 20 what really are motors, and they're operating in their own little universe. And these motors, everyone, if any one of them is out of whack, it can't function. But these are incredibly complex little things.
And that's what amazes me, Pat, about all of this, because everything has a purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, these things don't happen by accident.
No.
I mean, even when you look at, and you talk to astronomers, as I do quite often, they're amazed at how things in the universe function, how planets orbit, how stars are necessary.
And how perfectly, how, with what precision.
Yeah. It is just how this planet, for example, needs the ozone layer. Who would think about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
For our survival, we need that. Who would come up with that?
And if we were just a few miles closer to the sun,
wouldn't work.
Or just a few miles further away, wouldn't work.
You and I would be here in parkas right now.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. And one of the opening, if you don't mind, I'll read just an opening paragraph here. And Cord wrote this. Things aren't always what they seem. As you read this, you probably think you're sitting perfectly still, like you and I are right now. Yet anything, or could anything be further from the truth right now? You're moving at four incredible speeds simultaneously. First, you're spinning in an easterly direction at 1,044 miles per hour. That's the speed at which Earth turns on its axis. Second, you're moving through space at 67,000 miles per hour, the speed at which this giant globe we call Earth orbits the Sun. Third, you're orbiting the Milky Way's galactic center at 490,000 miles per hour. That's the speed at which everything in the galaxy spins around the Milky Way's center of mass. And fourth, as the universe expands, if it does, everything in it is hurtling outward at lightning speed. The speed varies depending on each object's location. And yet even that's not the end of the story. He says the expansion rate is accelerating. He says, look at the book you're reading. Look at every inanimate object around you. To all appearances, everything's perfectly still. But once we put the microscope, and I've quit reading now, but once we put the microscope on even inanimate objects like a rock, a clod of dirt, a table, this bottle of water, it is a seething mass of activity.
Absolutely.
And energy and precision and perfection. And to think, now, I've come up with two axioms, and I don't know if they're totally original. I've never heard anybody say them. One is that perfection has never been known to emerge from chaos. It no scientific principle can substantiate the notion that perfection, and we live in a universe that exhibits as close to perfection as
true
we can
perfection.
Imagine. You know?
It would be too astronomical.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. The other is only life begets life. So when Ben Stein asked these scientists, and these atheists, who are very confident about, seem to be very confident about their atheism, where did life originate? Well, a guy named Dawkins, who was one of the foremost evolutionary scientists, said, well, that we don't know. In fact, each of them said, well, we don't know yet where life or how it originated. We've got our theories. But so Ben pressed him a little bit, this guy Dawkins. He said, well, you must have some idea that you think explains how life began from inanimate objects. It had to have a beginning somewhere. Intelligence. And he said, well, maybe one of the theories is aliens from outer space. Well,
but who jump-started them?
Yeah, of course. The next question. Where did they? You cannot go back to a time scientifically when life sprang into any sort of being. Now, they say amino acids in that primordial ooze. But that theory now has been totally discredited because now that we know more about what the makeup of an early globe might have been, an early world, it no longer bears any resemblance to the theory that he created when he thought that amino acids could somehow rub together if you gave them a billion years and then something would spark to life. But they still can't answer where did light, mass, energy come from?
These are great questions. Let's take some calls here, Pat.
Okay.
You ready? Let's go to Richard in Concord, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Richard, thanks for calling.
Hey, George, great show as usual.
Thank you.
And God bless you, Pat Boone.
Ah, thank you. You too.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, I grew up pretty much conservative. My father was a Marine Corps in World War II, but and he didn't like the Beatles, and he thought all that stuff was like communist, according to him.
Yeah.
but I remember something. You were talking about the younger generation and you know, their respect for their elders and everything.
Yeah.
And you kind of touched on something that affected me at one time. Back in the early 70s, I got in a little bit of trouble with the law, some traffic ticket. So they sent me to a work furlough program, and it was in a veterans hospital. And I'm in there polishing the floors. And there was World War I veterans in there. I mean, guys that were pilots, you know, dropping bombs with their hands. And they just wanted me to sit down and talk with them.
Uh-huh.
And it was really an enlightening experience.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed that. And I just wish the younger generation was like that. But
yeah.
As time is going on, they're getting worse and worse.
Yeah, there are a lot of things being crammed down, crammed into the minds of young people that neither they nor their parents want, because that's the educational system. That's what the teachers' unions and so on have decreed must be taught, and that's what Ben Stein's film deals with, is the really the bigotry of it, that they will not let even another theory be taught. But kids can learn so much from their parents and from their grandparents, and really that was the way humanity has always proceeded.
Yeah.
And sure, you learn from your parents, and you didn't. You tended to believe. See, when I got started, there was no rock and roll, if you can imagine, and there was no teen market. I mean, clothes makers sold stuff to various size human beings,
sure,
but they didn't try to design stuff specifically for teens like they do now, and there was no rock and roll. So I grew up loving Bing Crosby. My parents liked Bing Crosby. Other people grew up liking classical music or blues, rhythm and blues, or jazz. But it was not till just about the time that I came along that the record producers were discovering nuggets of good music in the rhythm and blues field, which was a separate genre, and then making pop records so that the Crew Cuts did Shaboom And I did Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally and Ain't That a Shame. And Elvis did Hound Dog and songs that had been around for a while, but they were known only to a, you know, a certain genre, a segment of music fans. And out of that primordial ooze came rock and roll. But there was animation, there was life, there was something that existed, and you can trace where it came from. And kids need to trace where they came from their parents, their grandparents, and try to pick up
so important
on their experience. Because if you don't know where you've come from, you may not really be able to figure out where you ought to go.
That's right. That's a good point. St. Louis caller, we go. Johnny, go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, my name's John. It's an honor to speak to you, Pat Boone. My dad was a Church of Christ minister, and he was very involved with NICE.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, I spent a lot of time hanging out there as a kid at their spring fairs and stuff. And I just want to say how much I appreciate, you know, how you were able to be in Hollywood. You had your foot in two places. You know, you were in Hollywood, which is, of course, very worldly. And
but
I know how strong you were committed to your religious roots. And
yeah, I was always, I never quit my church involvement. In fact, George Norrie looked at me sort of quizzically, NICE, what was that? It wasn't just an adjective, nice, but, and that was a word I was already cringing from, because people were referring to me as that nice Pat Boone, and that didn't sound very commercial back then. This was 56, 57, 58. My career was white hot, but I was approached by a publisher, G.P. Putnam, to do a book of advice for teens. And I wrote a book called Twixt 12 and 20. They didn't like the title. It was hard to say, but I said, I don't want to use the word teen.
Yeah.
It seemed exploitive. But let me call it Twixt 12 and 20, a book of advice for teens. All the proceeds, and we didn't know what they'd be, if any, but they went to a startup Christian college in Philadelphia, in Villanova. An estate had been given. Some Christians were starting this college, and they named it Northeastern Institute for Christian Education. The book took off, became a huge bestseller. Wound up, I didn't take a nickel, but about $1.5 million went to found that school, which still exists, fully accredited. And so I thought I was going to be a teacher. Instead, I helped found a college.
Well, what I like about questions about God, it's about science, it's about faith, it's about merging both of them together. By the way, in the future, and when will this be, Pat? PatBoone.com. When do we get to see this?
Well, you mean the book or the PatBoone.com?
The website.
The website I was telling you about, I'm going to turn it into a 24/7 jukebox playing some 1,500 songs that I've recorded in 50 years. 50-plus years now, and I don't know if anybody else has ever done that, but now the technology does exist, so it's going to be, it would be probably in a couple of weeks, patboone.com. We're changing our website right now, and there'll be hundreds of pictures that'll just morph continually. And the book, I guess the book, you'd have to get it.
Maybe Amazon.com?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a website, answersthatcouldchangeyourlife.org. I think it is. Let's see. I think
super.
So. No, .com. Answers that could change your life.com. And I really think that anybody with an open mind at all, if you'll read this short 150-page book, will have answers to the questions you've always asked.
I love it. It's a good read.
Yeah.
It's a good read. Pat Boone, thanks again. You're always welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, George.
Pat Boone. I'll be back in a moment with Stacey Horn. Unbelievable next on Coast to Coast AM.